Hello there, and welcome all to The Forum, where science comes to socialize, the official podcast of the Institute on Science for Global Policy. My name's Aubrey, and as per usual, I'm joined today by my co-hosts Cleo and Daniela.
Thanks for tuning in today, everyone.
So, how's today going, you two? Easy day so far, not too many phone calls or emails or difficult decisions. Did you wake up on the right side of the bed? Chill day at work, cool as a cucumber.
I like to think I'm always bubbly and ready to take on the day. Thanks for asking. What's up with you, Cleo? What an odd way to open the show.
I'm just saying that I hope you haven't had to think too hard yet today. It's relatively early in the workday, so you might just be okay.
What are you talking about?
I see what you're doing, Cleo. Daniela, Cleo's giving you a hard time, partially because she's Cleo and it's what she does, and partially because today's episode topic is a heavy one involving a lot of thinking and mental rigor.
That's right. Today we're going to be talking a lot about morals and ethics and how they play a role in our food system.
So you want my brain fresh and ready to tackle the challenge?
That'd be ideal, yes.
Well, let's get started then. Today's episode is derived from a policy position paper titled Technological Safeguards for the U.S. Food Supply, Moral and Ethical Dilemmas, which was written by Dr. H. Morgan Scott at Texas A&M University.
Dr. Scott's paper was debated at the 2015 ISGP Academic Partnership Conference at Aubrey's alma mater, Ursinus College, which was themed Safeguarding the American Food Supply.
Oh, and before we get too far ahead of ourselves, please don't forget to send us your thoughts on today's topic using social media. You'll find us on Twitter and Facebook. Okay, carry on.
Well, I'm actually really excited to talk about morals and ethics today. It's a tough conversation to have because there's no one right answer when it comes to food supply ethics, which makes policy in that area even harder to develop.
Absolutely. It's pretty widely accepted that the global population is growing to the crazy high number of 9 billion in the next 35 years. And it's also predicted that the middle class will grow substantially. An obvious consequence to this is a need for more food, and many people think this means we'll require more animal protein.
And despite the fact that protein can definitely come from non-animal sources, Dr. Scott mentions that this protein need has led to the belief that we'll have to accept some newer, more controversial meat-providing technologies in the future.
Like GMOs, which we've talked about approximately 1,254 times on this show, but there are many more examples, like growth hormones and steroidal implants in animals, routine use of antibiotics to prevent disease and promote growth, or beta-adrenergic agonists supplied to pigs, turkeys, and cows to make them grow more and faster.
I'm not sure, Cleo. Is the point of these technologies to make the animals grow? I really couldn't tell from your statement.
Yes, Sassy. The point of these technologies is often to make animals grow, both in terms of mass of meat and rate of growth. It's not hard to see how this could result in providing a growing population with more animal protein.
If you say growing one more time.
Growing.
All right, enough you two. Anyway, animal technologies that might harm animals or increase antibiotic resistance are questionable at best. And Dr. Scott argues that some, if not all, of these technologies have complicated ethical implications because their benefits and risks fall on different groups, either physically, like humans versus animals, or temporally, like present-day humans versus future humans.
And these implications have already found their way into the policy sphere. Take the use of antibiotics in animal production, for instance. In June of 2010, Dr. Joshua Sharfstein, who was FDA Deputy Commissioner at the time, stated that we need to use antibiotics as wisely as possible to preserve their future efficacy. This was part of an argument suggesting that we shouldn't be using antibiotics to promote animal growth, but only protect their health.
Implicit in Sharfstein's statement is a moral ethical pronouncement. The moral suggestion is that we have a duty to preserve the efficacy of antibiotics for the future, and the ethical implication is that to achieve this goal, we need to use antibiotics responsibly at present. Two industrial policy guidelines actually ended up being made by the FDA in regards to this judgment.
Okay, but is the antibiotic use always irresponsible? It was noted by debaters that economic gain isn't generally the reason that producers seek to use antibiotics in the first place.
That's true. They more commonly cite a desire to prevent illness in their animals. This in itself is somewhat of a moral claim, so maybe these moral or ethical factors are already playing a bigger role in food production decision-making than we think.
I'm not gonna lie, I really thought the primary reason for antibiotic use in agriculture these days was for growth promotion and to consequently earn more money. Apologies for my misconceptions, people. But I guess this is a really great example of why it's important to have all stakeholders and implicated parties around the table when discussing these delicate matters.
For sure. And so another example in which ethics are being argued in the food policy sphere involves those beta adrenergic agonists we referenced earlier. Beta adrenergic agonists, or BAAs, are medications that make it easier for smooth muscles to relax and heart tissue to contract. The immediate result is widening of the airways and easier breathing. But the ultimate effect when used in animal production is enhanced growth, improved feeding efficiency, and more meat protein generation.
When BAAs were approved for use in the United States, it was believed that benefits to the food producers outweighed the risks to the animals. Plus, the BAAs had no effect on consumer health. But since that time, evidence has suggested that BAAs can actually negatively impact animal well-being.
Not to mention that increased animal mortality has been recorded with the use of BAAs.
And making policies based on something like animal well-being means making policies based on a value judgment. But value-based policymaking is often considered inadequate because of its inherent subjectivity.
In cases like this, consumer demand and the resulting economics can really be drivers for change, almost like creating some type of informal policy.
Right. For instance, the sale of one BAA, called Zilpaterol, was voluntarily banned by its very manufacturer. Now you might ask, why in the world would a manufacturer ban its own product? And the reason makes a lot of economic sense. Animals raised with Zilpaterol later in life were arriving to processing plants with missing hooves, aka questionable health and well-being. This made consumers skeptical, which made retailers suffer, which made packers pretty unhappy, which made the manufacturer change its ways.
It's probably worth noting that while BAAs are approved for growth promotion use in the United States, they aren't in many other areas, including the European Union. This is somewhat of a trend, and when the U.S. approves food production technologies that aren't accepted in other countries, the products can't be exported, so their prices are lowered domestically.
So, we've talked about consumer pressure being a driver for positive change in the area of food production technologies. I even remember the debaters bringing up the example of McDonald's making supply chain changes to appease customers who were angry about the use of antimicrobials in chickens. But can this consumer vocalization also have negative effects?
That's actually a great question, Dee. And I guess the answer is, it depends on how you define negative. I'll give you an example. Debaters mentioned recombinant bovine somatotropin, or RBST, during Dr. Scott's session. RBST is a synthetic version of a growth hormone naturally found in milk. If supplied to dairy cows, it increases their milk yield.
RBST hasn't been shown to have any ill effects on cows or on humans that consume the cow's milk, but the public is suspicious, probably because the term growth hormone typically raises eyebrows and turns heads.
So basically, dairy producers haven't been using RBST because of indirect public pressure, despite the fact that higher milk yields could mean fewer cows needed and consequent environmental benefits.
Ugh, but it's all so complicated. Look, a lot of people in the food and agriculture research community, and even some Fortune 500 companies, are basically saying that we have to prioritize the needs of the future population when it comes to food production. How do we even begin to prioritize the needs of humans, animals, and the environment of today? Then you throw in humans, animals, and the environment of tomorrow, and, well, I'm stumped.
Well, that's just it. No one really knows who should be prioritized. Should it be the health of today's population and animal welfare, or should it be the unborn and people 2, 3, or 10 generations down the line?
The debaters thought that policy decisions must seek to ethically feed the world's current population in order to even think about preparing to feed future generations. They certainly felt that humane and sustainable food production practices need to be prioritized regardless. They were sure to include environmental awareness in this categorization.
I'd even go as far as to say that preventing further environmental degradation was one of the debaters' priorities.
It was even suggested that plant protein be explored more fully as a viable, environmentally friendly means of increasing our protein yields.
But it's no secret that, in general, views regarding prioritization here are varied at best.
Actually, I think Dr. Scott puts it really, really well. He asks, quote, "Do we sacrifice tangible, if conflicted, moral obligations in the immediate present in favor of a more nebulous obligation to unknown, unknowable, or even unconceived persons in the future?" Unquote.
That's deep.
But legit.
Definitely legit. And if we're to believe that more animal protein is needed as the years go on and the populations increase, we'll need to be able to untangle these complications, at least well enough that we can make some concrete policy surrounding these issues.
We've had population booms in the past, and we were able to make more food then. Why are we suddenly hitting these roadblocks?
Well, Dee, we didn't really have to worry about hurting all the plants we produced in the Green Revolution. In today's case, the health of our furry and feathered friends is at stake.
And that's why Dr. Scott says that technology is having the potential to help the food security challenge, but also hurt different players in this moral game, human, inhuman, and not yet existent, need to be rigorously examined prior to their approval. It's all about cost-benefit analysis here, folks.
How is this rigorous analysis supposed to be carried out? Well, it has a lot to do with dialogue. Dialogue between regulators and representatives of the impacted groups. And yes, this does include representatives advocating for animals and their welfare.
Allow me to finally bring up the elephant in the room, or in this case, the really obvious question that I'm sure is on everyone's mind. What happens when these stakeholders have slightly different moral or ethical values? Or worse, when their values conflict?
Then we all sigh in frustration and go home. At least that's what I want to do.
The debaters absolutely brought this up, but there was definitely more work to be done here.
See, I told you today's episode would be hard. I'm going home.
Well, what I know that the debaters did decide was that panels need to be created from the local to the international level in order to regulate animal production technologies. One thing is certain. The panel's members need to be widely representative, as previously discussed, as well as scientifically informed and culturally sensitive.
Okay, I'm done pouting now, mostly because that makes a lot of sense.
In general, though, it's still safe to say that the situation's complicated because of a need to protect about a million different stakeholders simultaneously by our production decisions.
And when it comes to protecting humans and their needs, it seems that some approval processes for meat production in the past have been a little hasty to jump the gun and risk human health.
Sounds like we've got a questionable track record to work with.
For instance, drugs are metabolized perfectly fine in healthy animals, but this isn't the case for their sick counterparts. This difference isn't accounted for when it comes to designating withholding periods before slaughter.
By the way, a withholding period is the period of time during which the animal is taken off any medications or antibiotics prior to slaughter. Withholding periods are meant to let the chemical flush out of the animal system so that it doesn't affect consumers.
That said, if withholding periods are designated based on metabolism in a healthy cow, they won't necessarily be applicable to a sick cow, and so there could be some consumer implications.
Basically, in this regard, Dr. Scott is looking for more holistic approaches to be used when it comes to designating regulations for things like withholding periods. Think one fish, two fish, red fish, blue fish, all the types of fish need to be considered.
Dr. Seuss would be proud.
Another idea that was described is developing a surveillance system for technologies post-approval, especially when those technologies aren't developed to improve animal health or well-being and are therefore more likely to put them at risk. It was stated that groups like the FDA or USDA could develop and monitor these systems.
You know, it seems like the approval of BAA use would be a great candidate for surveillance here. If there had been a system already in place, maybe it wouldn't have had to be consumer, retailer, and manufacturer pressure that resulted in the zilpaterol voluntary ban, and a formal ban could have come sooner.
The debaters were sure to note that post-approval surveillance systems do exist, but they focus narrowly on the development of antibiotic resistance in the animals. Not only is this examining just one feature of well-being, one impact, if you will, but antibiotic resistance takes years, a decade even, to develop.
So many other effects can take root within a 10-year span.
Exactly, which is why post-approval surveillance needs to be expanded.
A broader surveillance system, as well as many of the requests for action made by Dr. Scott, seems to rely more on a qualitative assessment of risk rather than the often prioritized quantitative variety. I mean, you really can't quantitate your values, morals, and ethics, and when it comes to animal welfare and caring about people five generations down the line, let's face it, we're talking about these value judgments.
I'm sure that'll go over real well. Taking away people's numbers, how will they ever make any decisions?
I don't know, but qualitative risk assessment definitely means including the consideration of moral imperatives and accepted ethical practices alongside the hard sciences associated with a proposed technology.
I guess that's true. It's easier to fall into the numbers pit when working with scientific data. You can't really put a number on whether or not it's okay to steal a cookie from the cookie jar.
Yes, you can. How many cookies are you going to steal from the cookie jar? If it's just one, it's not even worth it.
Okay, fair. Bad example.
But in all seriousness, this qualitative judgment is actually pretty important. Think of it this way. We can't ask a cow, on a scale of 1 to 10, how she's feeling today. When it comes to considering the well-being of animals and future humans, we're operating somewhat in the dark.
Dr. Scott has another eloquent line which sums up the situation nicely. He asks, who speaks for the future? Who speaks for those with no voice, i.e. the animals?
His answer to these questions is less about the who and more about the how. It's necessary that we actively seek to do no harm to these current and future beings, so constant vigilance and evaluation is necessary to make sure we're putting this desire into practice.
Because according to our presenter, it's our responsibility to, quote, assess well-being, minimize discomfort, and explore and adopt the best alternatives, end quote, when available.
In agreement with this assertion, the debaters discussed the possible need for third-party auditors who would assess animal well-being and discomfort, as well as suggest responsible technological alternatives within the animal production industry.
Hey, don't Pennsylvania and Wisconsin already have independent auditors examine production facilities for ethical animal treatment?
Yep, they do.
But, you know, it's not just how we produce animal protein that's an ethical question here. Related is the question of who gets access to the protein, what kind, and how much.
True. And I think the answers to those questions really depend on what society you're talking about. For instance, in less affluent nations, animal agriculture usually occurs on a smaller, at-home scale, and the animals themselves are considered part of a family's assets.
On the other hand, more affluent nations typically acquire their animal protein from large-scale manufacturing operations. It was suggested that these nations would be the ones that could afford to switch to alternative sources of protein if necessary, not the less affluent ones.
And we can't forget one of the biggest sources of protein and other foods altogether.
Daniela, how many times do I have to tell you that zombies aren't real, let alone a good source of protein?
Oh, stop. I meant food waste.
I suppose that if we could reduce our food waste, we could help address the future food security problem without increasing food production or needing these controversial technologies.
Or zombies, but that's the idea. In 2014, the USDA found that enough food to feed 870 million people is wasted worldwide each and every year, and it costs $400 billion to dispose of this waste.
To be fair, this isn't exclusively the fault of the consumers, although they are to blame for many food waste issues, but that's a whole other show. Some public health rules currently in place, like rules that restrict our ability to feed waste to pigs, kind of promote food waste.
There are ways to reduce this problem and make food waste less of an issue, like treating the waste before feeding it to the pigs. Unfortunately, the current economic situation hasn't made investing in these types of technologies or associated labor costs financially sound.
Well, maybe it's time to turn that around. the debaters felt that consumer education regarding food waste, as well as improvements to the food supply chain to eliminate post-production waste, is crucial for the future of feeding the world.
Although it would be naive to say that the answer to our food security and ethical questions is a singular, simple solution. In order to address our nutritional, environmental, and animal treatment challenges, a variety of options should be explored.
And these options hinge on accommodating the needs, both physical and moral, of all implicated parties, from Bessie on the farm to Bill in accounting.
Getting those stakeholders together is assuredly step one of a long and arduous process, but you've got to start somewhere.
So we've left a lot of questions on the table today. The biggest one probably being, what happens when the moral and ethical values of two stakeholders conflict? Well, what do you think should be done?
Or how about this one? Can a framework be created by which policies are established according to value-based factors? Is this even possible? And if so, is it a good solution?
Please send us your thoughts on these and other issues discussed in today's episode online. You'll find us on Twitter at ISGPForum, where you can tag your comments with the hashtag ISGPForum, or you can post on our Facebook wall at facebook.com/ISGPForum.
Thanks for joining us here at the Institute on Science for Global Policy today and taking some time to socialize the science. Hope your brain didn't explode. And if you survived, we'll catch you next time right here on the forum.
The Institute on Science for Global Policy, or ISGP, is a nonprofit organization that convenes international meetings bringing together scientists, policymakers, industry leaders, students, and other stakeholders to discuss pertinent scientific issues facing society. The ISGP has no opinions and does not lobby. Therefore, the preceding podcast reflects the views expressed by the presenters and debaters at our conference. For more information, please visit our website at www.scienceforglobalpolicy.org. Thank you.